So before we get into Job chapter 1, verse 6 to 22, we'll finish out chapter 1 tonight. There's one announcement just briefly. Last week, I announced that we were going to begin recording these evening services for the podcast, and the first one has been posted. Does anybody take a chance to look at it? Holly, yay! Ed James, awesome. So if you notice, the Q&A afterwards, the dialogue we have is not on the recordings, because we're going to take, Donald and I are going to take a Martin Lloyd-Jones view and believe that we cannot duplicate that type of environment and that type of dialogue on an audio recording. It's just not the same as being there in person. You can't quite hear anything. It's jumbled. It's strange having to repeat every question for those of you present. And so we're not going to do that. So each of these, we're going to try and keep to about 30 to 35 minutes, if possible, so we have time for questions. Because in sections of the text that we're hitting tonight, where we look, if you will, behind the curtain, it causes all sorts of questions to come forth. So we need to make sure to have time for those. Any questions about the podcast? Awesome. So, in the Valley of Vision, the prayer book that we have so often recommended to you to work into your devotional life, to work into your family worship, to work into our corporate life here as a congregation, there is a prayer that I prayed at the end of our prayer time called Man's Great End. It's in the section on the Trinity, and it's on page 13. It begins, let me remind you, with this phrase, or these words. Lord of all being, there is one thing that deserves my greatest care, that calls forth my ardent desires, that is, that I may answer the great end for which I am made, to glorify you who has given me being. None of us would disagree with this statement. Right? So in other words, our life is lived to no purpose unless that purpose is glorifying the God who made us for His glory. If we're not living in that vein, we're living empty. None of us, on the surface of things, would disagree with such statements. Therefore, it would be right to say that the glory of God is more important than our comfort. Right? The glory of God is more important than our comfort. But are there not implications to this statement that make us squirm just a little bit? I mean, if we're honest, what if God decides to glorify Himself by stripping everything away from us? Do we still believe that statement? You don't have to answer out loud, but these are the questions that are presented to us. We want to say yes, but an honest assessment, an honest answer may reveal the depths of what we truly care about the most and bring us to our knees in repentance. In the first five verses of Job, last Sunday evening, we looked at a well-run world where the great and the godly are one in the same. At least in us, in the East, with Job. The world runs as it ought to be. But in verse 6, we're introduced to a new development. That well-run world is given to all sorts of disorder and chaos. And in this, we see one thing clearly. In God's world, there is a need for God to be seen as glorious apart from everything that He's done for us. Or in other words, will Job continue to love and praise and honor and glorify God and live a life devoted to Him if all the stuff God has given him is taken away? Will he still love God, or does he love Him just for what he can get from him. And so this is the question that hits us tonight. And it shows us that when all of Job's greatness is taken away, that he continues to be a godly man shows us that God is truly worthy of worship apart from everything that he has done for us. And by remaining to be godly when all is stripped away, Job gives us a breathtaking preview of the man, the God-man, who would walk a harder road of suffering for us and do the exact same thing, Jesus Christ. So in these verses, verse 6 to 22, there are two scenes to behold. Scene 1, I don't know if this is where whoever wrote The Wizard of Oz got it, but we get to see the behind the curtain, if you will, of the events in Uz, and we get to peer into heaven at a day. There was a day, verse 6. Then there was a day, verse 13. And what a day they were. So heaven and earth are the two scenes that we will linger on this evening. So follow along as I read verse 6 to 12 as we look into scene 1. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. There was a day. Verse 6. And Christopher Ashe in his commentary says, "What a day it was." The events of this day, Job, ironically, never finds out about. Which is another reason why Job could not have authored this book, because the details of this day are in the book. But this day would have been for Job the foundation of the undoing of all of his comfort, all of his blessings, all of his greatness. It would change Job's life forever. We read that the sons of God, meaning, there's all sorts of opinions here, I'm going to take it, that the sons of God, meaning the heavenly court, the divine council, came to stand before God, and that they came to present themselves to God shows us something of a hierarchy. It shows us that these supernatural beings, though higher than men, are lower than God. And so when summoned, what do? They come. And they present themselves before the only one who sits on the throne, the one who's ruling and reigning over his creation. And so do not interpret this scene as something like Mount Olympus, where gods of equal power are having some type of council to decide how they ought to run the world, and competing wills with equal strengths, and whoever wins, or whoever overpowers the conversation, wins, and his rule, or her rule, is then carried out. This text prohibits us from seeing such a view. Here, only God is God, only God is on the throne, and only God wields the authoritative power in this gathering. So all those present, we can conclude that They are the ones through whom God runs the world. They are, in a sense, agents of his providence. And no doubt, when we see this divine council or heavenly court enter into session, it makes every other human government, court, or meeting look puny in comparison. No doubt. We do not know the guest list for this meeting, but we do know one person who was there, Satan. We also do not know, because maybe this answers some of your questions, maybe not. There's also opinions here we can discuss after. Why was Satan there? Was he a regular attender at these councils, at these gatherings? Or was he something of a meeting crasher who was not invited, but who came in anyway? Well, whatever the case is, you figure that one out. God speaks to him in verse 7. From where have you come? Think about the question. God is God. Will God learn anything he does not already know from asking Satan this question? No, is the correct answer. And so we automatically have to assume and can conclude with certainty that this question that God asks Satan is similar in nature to the question God asks Adam in the garden. Where are you? God knew where Adam was. The question was not for God's benefit to learn something that he did not already know. The question was for Adam's benefit back then, that he would understand by saying it himself that he was hiding, that he was wrong, and that he was the one sinning. It would have been an acknowledgement of guilt. And so we see something of the similar meaning here. This question is not meant to tell God what he does not know about Satan's doings. It seems to show us by implication that God already knows that Satan is up to no good, and he wants Satan to voice this out loud in the midst of this heavenly council. I think that Satan's response confirms this as we see him answer. So where have you come from? From going to and fro on the earth and walking up and down on it. Those of you with teenagers, or were recently teenagers yourself, this is something of not a stretch for you to think about, because this is when you ask a teenager, what did you do today? What's the normal response? Nothing. Stuff. Really? You've done more. Perhaps you've done stuff you don't want me to know about, so you're just going to say nothing. This is a similar answer that Satan gives here. It's similar in its slipperiness. It reveals that there's more to the story that this individual does not want to share. So, God, knowing this, in verse 8, goes with where he already knows Satan is going. Have you considered? Have you considered my servant Job? So God is aware of Satan's intentions to attack one of his own. God then repeats what we've already learned in chapter 1, verse 1 to 5, here in verse 8, that he fears God, he's blameless, he's upright, and he turns away from evil. Yet it is these fateful words, have you considered my servant Job, that single out Job as the godly man who will now experience incredible testing, extreme testing. These words single him out, and they prove devastating, devastating in their consequences for Job. Just as Jesus in John 11, when he heard about his friend Lazarus being sick and he waited 2 days to allow him to die, So too, God, being very pleased by the life of his servant Job, he's the one who points him in the direction of Job. He was not Satan's choice, it was God's choice. But Satan believes something different about Job. That he's not as holy on the outside as he is on the inside. He may appear to be godly and embracing the power of godliness, but it's just a show. He is not on the inside what he is on the outside. And so in verse 9 and 10, Satan does what Satan does. The word means in Hebrew accuser or adversary. And so he accuses Job. He's only godly because you, notice, have hedged him in. Perhaps this is where the ridiculous phrase praying for a hedge of protection comes from. If you want to go somewhere to get a biblical proof for that, it's here. Just a side comment. But he says God has hedged him in tightly, blessed the work of his hands greatly, and increased his possessions vastly. This is why Job is godly. Not because of who God is, but because of what Job can get from God in return. More so, Satan says in verse 11 that the only way to establish with certainty that Job is who he appears to be truly is to take the hedge away, to stop blessing the work of his hands, and to remove his possessions publicly for all to see. Satan's intentions are horrible here for sure, but do not miss that they are correct. Now follow me here. God already knows what Job would do if he has everything removed. No one else does. So it's true that the only way to publicly prove to the watching world and to Satan himself, the seemingly intruder to this heavenly divine council, that Job truly is godly and that God truly is worthy of worship, is to take everything away from Job and to prove this point once and for all. That Job loves God and not just for what he can get. Now, it would be appropriate if we were to flip this story on its head. We could say something similar like this. If Job were a very godly poor man, the test would look like giving him immense riches to see if he loved God for who he truly was or if he loved God because of all the stuff that he had just gotten. So you could flip it on his head. Either way, rich Job becoming poor Job or poor Job becoming rich Job, the root of Job's love toward God will be exposed for all to see if it's genuine or not. And so in verse 12, God gives the terrible instruction and permission. Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. We have to pause here and talk about something that we're probably not very comfortable with. We do not like the idea, let's just be honest, of God permitting Satan to attack Job. We do not like this idea. But that's what happens. For all his hatred, do you see that Satan is doing something, that God is using Satan to do something very public for his glory? For all to see. In a deep way, it is necessary for it to be publicly seen by the watching world that God is worthy of worship apart from his blessings given to men. So ironically, part of this heavenly council, or at least in this scene, the evil one is present And God wields him for very good purpose. The purpose is a role of opposition. To be sure, it's a role of hostility that's full of hate, but it's a role nonetheless that God wields for his own glory. And so do not think that Satan is God's equal and the two of them are now locked in an epic chess match for the heart of Job. God alone is God. He knows the end from the beginning, and he ordains, as the catechism says, whatsoever comes to pass. And so all of this teaches, as Martin Luther was fond of saying, that Satan is only God's Satan. Satan is God's Satan. He only allows him to go as far as he lets the leash out. And he can go no further. That should be something of an encouragement to us. And so, when in the governments of all things, God sees fit to glorify himself through the devil, he does so. He does so. And perhaps we need to remember our first thought from the evening, from our prayer, man's great end. God's glory is more important than our comfort. Job got a first-hand lesson in this. And Christ got a first-hand lesson in this. And we ourselves, though I must say to a vastly lower degree, the Christian life is a lesson in this. Every time we suffer in any way, shape, or form, this resembles this greater suffering in view. That more is happening than meets the eye, and that God always leads us well. It's some of the things we learn here in this first scene. So let's move on to scene two. In verse 13 to 22, we've already seen the first scene, and now, as soon as we get from 12 to 13, we move from heaven to earth. From the first specific day in verse 6 to a new specific day in verse 13, it begins like any other day, but it does not end like any other day Job has ever experienced in his entire life. Four messengers come to Job with their own message, wave upon wave. Job's greatness is stripped. And so, in a sense, one commentator said that these four messengers to Job seem probably more like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Let's read verse 13 to 19 first. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you." Verse 13 sets the stage. We see that these kids are having another one of their infamous birthday parties, it seems. It's the oldest brother's turn this time, and so they're all at his house, wining and dining, and no doubt Job is already preparing the next day's offerings for all 10 of them. Then we see the first intrusion. The first intrusion comes in verse 14 and 15 with news that all of Job's oxen and donkeys have been taken and the servants caring for them have been killed. Before we can catch our breath, another messenger comes in verse 16 with the second intrusion, saying not only have the oxen and donkeys been destroyed, but now all of Job's sheep are destroyed because what? Fire from heaven. Lightning is probably what's in view here. And it took the servants caring for them as well. And again, before we can catch our breath from the first two messengers, verse 17 gives us our third intrusion with the third messenger. All of Job's camels have been stolen by the Chaldeans, and the servants caring for them have been killed as well. First, it was the oxen, the donkeys with some servants, then the sheep with the servants, then the camels with the rest of those servants. And as these three messages hit Job wave after wave, you can only imagine him standing or sitting there in stunned silence, probably having trouble thinking that he has just been, in terms of ancient Near Eastern culture and an agrarian society, he was great and he is now bankrupt. Possessions gone. He did the opposite of what we see so many movies. He went from riches to rags. But poor Job doesn't have time to process these losses as the fourth intrusion comes. And we as the reader, we dread what's coming next, and we, in a sense, wonder why this account of this day began with the description of the oldest son's birthday party. Why did you tell us all the kids were together? A great wind blew down the house and all the children in it, and they are dead. If we dwell on these four waves long enough, it is not difficult to weep with Job. Two terror attacks and two natural disasters in one day make the greatest man in all the East the most despairing man in all the East. And we remember again our beginning thought. The glory of God is more important than our comfort, right? Do we still believe this? We know it's true, and Job does too, but Job doesn't get the privilege of seeing behind the curtain like we got to see into the details of God's providential governance of all things. And so what will he do? Will he curse God and reveal that he only loved God because of all this great blessing that had come his way? Or will his heart reveal that he loves God no matter what befalls him? In verse 20 and 21, Charles Spurgeon calls Job's rare pearls. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So after all this has taken place, he acknowledges how he entered the world is the same way that he will exit the world. Naked and with nothing. And in the dark of life, he worships, confessing that God is God. And dark as his road now may be, whatever God ordains for him is right. And so Job's words have stood the test of time. Here's the whole quote from Spurgeon. "Some of the rarest pearls have been found in the deepest of waters. Some of the choicest utterances of believers have come when God's waves and billows have been made to roll over them. If you have seen if you've read the Screwtape letters. Oh, you have the audio? Ooh, that'd be kind of creepy. Yeah. If you've read them or listened to them, though, you're aware that this is one of the things that befuddles the tempters. When everything is stripped away, why do the enemy's people, why do we still praise God and still love God? They cannot understand this, Lewis talks about. And in verse 22, we see the wonderful conclusion to a horrible story. In all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. And again, we have to say time out and say this is a verse that you have to remember throughout the rest of the book, because his friends that proved to be horrible friends, who were silent, like we said last week, for way too long when they first came to meet him, do not believe verse 22. They believe that Job is on the outside a fraud and that he is hiding and harboring some type of secret sin that no one knows about. And because of this, that's why all this suffering has happened to him. Yet look at God's declaration of Job. Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him. And so what God says of him proves true of him in verse 22. He did not sin or charge God with wrong. And so once again, I'll say that Job's suffering is unique and extreme. None of you have suffered two terrorist attacks or two natural disasters removing everything that you've ever owned in one day. This is extreme suffering meant and inspired by the Holy Spirit to prepare us for the one who would be greater than Job, yet like Job, innocently suffer and bear the curse for others. And so we see a picture of Jesus who remained faithful in the midst of testing on a harder road than Job ever did here. And that's where these scenes leave us. And perhaps this is now where questions can begin.